At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, two stories of Detroit, the good and the ugly. There's another convention out there to catch up with, in case you hadn't heard, and a little bit of Freakonomics Radio as well from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 4th of September. And we know that figuring cause and effect in a beast as complicated as the American economy can be a tricky business. That said, though, sales figures out from carmakers today do give us a chance to take a peek under the hood, if you will. GM sales rose 10% last month, Ford 13%. Chrysler had its best August since 2007, 5 years ago. Driving things was an economic concoction of pent-up demand, better supplies, easier credit, and, as Adrian Hill explains now from the Marketplace desk of Go Figure, glimmers of hope in the housing market.
For years, we've blamed the housing market for every which woe in our economy. Well, today, it might deserve a small pat on the back.
Housing starts are actually up about 21% compared to last year this time. And guess what? New car sales are also up nearly as much.
Jesse Toprock is with TrueCar.com.
Well, a lot of times, the spark in housing market gives signals to small businesses and construction businesses to go buy new trucks.
And right on cue, pickup truck sales were up in August. But don't go writing a thank you note to the housing market just yet. It's done some, sure, but most of the credit for improved auto sales numbers goes rightfully to the other factors Kai mentioned, demand, supply, and credit access. And not to sound ungrateful, but the housing sector could do more. Lacey Plackey is chief economist at Edmunds.com. She says as home prices tick up, homeowners feel wealthier.
And so this increase in confidence leads people to feel better about their personal situation and to go out and buy.
But Plackey says we're going to need to wait on that bounce.
The slight upturn that we're seeing probably isn't going to make anybody feel like they need to start spending in any significant way.
The other difference housing can make, homeowners using their houses as piggy banks to buy that new car. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Not to totally kill your post-Labor Day buzz, but I'm here to tell you it's time to start thinking, if you can believe this, about your holiday shopping. Honestly, it is, because retailers are. Toys R Us announced it's starting its holiday layaway plan a month early, today, in fact. Walmart is getting a jump on layaway purchases as well, and both Sears and Kmart are offering discounts to shoppers who use their layaway plans. From New York, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains what's going on.
Let the holiday shopping season begin. Starting today, Toys R Us will waive its $5 layaway fee and its minimum price requirement. Now you can buy a $2 gift on an installment plan. Troy Rice is the Executive Vice President of Stores and Services for Toys R Us.
We think that it's very important to do what we can to assist our customers to stretch their budgets further.
Layaway had pretty much gone away until the Great Recession, when retailers revived it as a solution for shoppers with bad credit. But Layaway 2.0 never really took off, says Allison Lipson, a retail analyst for Mintel Research.
When it first came out, kind of came back, but I think overall it hasn't had the long-term effect that some retailers may have expected it to.
So if people aren't really using Layaway, why are stores pushing it so hard?
so retailers don't wind up in the middle of December with a lot of merchandise that they're not selling.
Ken Goldstein is an economist at the Conference Board. He says it's not so much the consumers' economic situations are worse. It's that they've gotten into the habit of waiting for last-minute holiday discounts. Retailers are hoping new layaway incentives will get people to shop early and pay full price.
Why are they looking to layaway plans as opposed to discounting? Because they're in the business of trying to make some money.
Goldstein points out many retailers count on the holidays for nearly half their income, and another season of mass markdowns would make for a very unhappy New Year. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
No mass markdowns on Wall Street today, but some soft B-list economic indicators put traders off their feet. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You've heard here and elsewhere about the local economic boost that political conventions are said to bring with them. It was true in Tampa with the GOP, and it's true as the Democrats have their confab in Charlotte this week as well. Although some of the most interesting job opportunities are somewhat unconventional, as Youth Radio's Sarah Quevedo reports.
What's up? Oh my goodness, you look like you're famished. Please, come down to Rock Bottom and grab something to eat.
24-year-old Chris Miller and a colleague are dressed in all black and baking in the 90-degree midday heat. They're handing out coupons for a nearby restaurant where they wait tables.
We have beer-themed food and beer-themed beer.
How much are you guys making?
Right now, we're making $2.13 an hour.
For $2.13 an hour without tips, this guy genuinely seems to be loving life.
Oh, beautiful.
So much so that he decided to sing a theme-appropriate song.
Radiation skies, for amber waves of gray.
Not 10 steps away, Trey Randleman is hawking shiny buttons with a very familiar face on them. It's this guy that a lot of people at the DNC seem to like. Okay, yeah, it's Obama. And he's looking pretty good on these pins.
Yeah, got him looking kind of sexy there.
That's my favorite, too. Besides the one where he's dressed like a Jedi warrior.
They're 1 for $5 and 3 for $10, so we've been doing pretty good today. You know, wherever the crowds are, you can pretty much get a sale, so that's what we're doing.
Randleman says 85% of the proceeds go to a food pantry, and she gets the other 15%. $5 adds up quickly. She can take home $150 to $200 a day.
We're just trying to make enough money to eat off the dollar menu today.
That's 17-year-old Mikey Stewart. He plays harmonica along with 16-year-old Thomas Watts on guitar. Together, they are
the Elaborate Door Retrievers.
They're sitting against a wall with the classic Starving Musician's guitar case open in front of them.
So what do you got in there?
$6.87. You don't even need to eat on the dollar menu now.
Now we can get somewhere fancy. Take you out somewhere nice.
Maybe we can afford Chick-fil-A.
And just when they thought their day had been made, a special guest showed up.
Let's try to play a song for Jesse Jackson.
All right, let's do that.
All right. Jesse, this song's dedicated for you.
There's only one act in Charlotte this week, but opportunists like the Elaborate Door Retrievers are hoping the spotlight shifts enough in their direction that they can make a little cash. In Charlotte, I'm Sarah Quevedo for Marketplace.
Sarah's story came to us courtesy of Youth Radio and its new Options Desk. Those are stories about how young adults can find a job. A story now from the Wealth and Poverty Desk.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
It's a story about the reality behind the pleasant surprise of today's car sales numbers. Detroit, as you know, has been in trouble for a long time. The decline of the auto industry, the recession, unemployment, none of that is new. But it's one thing to know intellectually that something's happening. It's something else entirely to see it or to hear it. You can do both in a new documentary that's out this week. It's from filmmaker Heidi Ewing and her partner Rachel Grady. Heidi is in studio with me. Also on the line is a featured player in the film, I guess you could say. Tommy Stevens is the owner of the Raven Lounge at the Blues Bar in Detroit. It's good to have you both with us.
Pleasure to be here.
My pleasure.
Heidi, let me start with you and ask, why Detroit and why this film?
Well, I was born and raised in the Detroit area. You know, my parents were really concerned. Things seemed to be sort of bellying out there in the city. And I kept wondering why and what happened here. And I thought maybe there'd be a film to be made there. So we went and sort of blindly, we moved to Detroit with our crew and waited for the city to speak to us and see what story it would tell us. And I think we found something compelling.
Tommy Stevens, do you feel that Detroit has been, even for all the press in the past 4 or 5 years about the auto industry and the bailouts and all that stuff, do you think the real Detroit has been forgotten?
Definitely. Yeah, I came to Detroit right before the riot in 1967, fell in love with it. Detroit was the first major city in America that's suffering what the nation is now suffering. We saw this early, and now we're on our way up.
You believe that? You feel that? Is it in the air?
I see the business coming back now.
There is a scene in the film. It's actually interesting because you are doing what I guess would be called like customer research. You go to the Detroit Auto Show, which is correctly called, I guess, the North American International Auto Show, and you go and you check out the Volt, and then you walk across the hall and you check out the Chinese version of that car. And we're gonna play a clip from the film right now. This is you at the Detroit Auto Show.
It's a better deal. I'm saying, my God.
Right.
I mean, the Volt, even though I wanted to succeed, has some genuine problems at 40-some thousand, and you are talking about 20?
Yes, 28.
You have to go out, don't you, Tommy Stevens, and figure out what the business environment is, isn't it?
Absolutely. In fact, I thought the lady did not understand the language and was quoting me the wrong price at 20,000.
Yeah, I mean, $20,000 for the BYD, for the Chinese version, and $40,000 for the Volt. Are you still hopeful now, knowing
that? Well,
them?
I do believe that if General Motors continue to work at it, we'll drop those prices down. But my God, $20,000?
Yeah.
That says something.
Heidi, there's another scene I want to ask you about. It seemed to me almost cannibalistic. It's these young kids, young guys, tearing apart what I guess was like an old auto plant, right?
It was an old Cadillac repair shop.
Well, explain that scene to us. I mean, they're literally tearing it apart.
It was a winter evening, and I was with my crew on my way somewhere else, and we saw these sort of sparks flying in this field. And we pulled the car up, and we started slowly walking towards this group of men. And they were basically single-handedly, with very rudimentary tools, disassembling a former Cadillac repair shop. And they were doing that because there was still steel, aluminum, and some copper, which is very valuable. Literally, they called themselves the cleanup crew. They said, the city should pay us. And I said, well, where's it going? And they said, well, we take it to the scrap metal shop, and then we're pretty sure it goes somewhere and gets melted down. And I said, and then what? They said, well, what do you think? It goes to China, where they make stuff and then sell it to us for a lot cheaper. As if it was a stupid question of where this was possibly going.
Totally unrelated to doing this interview. I was reading something a couple of weeks ago about the Michigan Central Station, that very, very famous train station. It used to be gorgeous train station in Detroit. And somebody called the constant attention on the demise of that structure. They called it decay porn.
Ruin porn. I've heard that term before.
Porn.
Well, we were very careful not to engage in what they call ruin porn. You can't ignore those structures when you make a film in Detroit. That would be also extremely dishonest. And I think we should embrace it. We should look at it. We should talk about it. But if we ignore some of the things that have happened to the city and just talk about, oh, yes, the young artists are saving the city, I'm fearful that everyone's just going to say, oh, it's come back. And it's funny how people just move on. And I'm hoping with this film, people will think again and not just move on.
Can we talk about the ending for a minute?
Spoiler alert?
No, I'm not spoiling
anything.
Nobody
dies.
This film ended, and it almost felt a little like you set up your case, you made your case, and then you didn't nail it home. You didn't say Detroit is doomed or Detroit's going to rebound. I didn't get that sense.
I think the story of Detroit is open-ended. I think it could go either way. I think this country could go either way. I think Detroit could go either way. So we hemmed and hawed, and we had many different endings. And you know what? We decided it's unknown. It's up to the rest of us, and it's up to Detroit what kind of decisions we're going to make.
The new film from Heidi Ewing and her partner, Rachel Grady, is called Detropia. In it, featured prominently is a guy by the name of Tommy Stevens. He's the owner of the Raven Lounge. It's Detroit's House of Blues. Thank you both for coming in.
It was a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. coming up.
I began to think a little bit, sort of counterintuitively that actually selling beer at our stadium would actually help us gain control.
Go for the game, stay for the beer, the Freakonomics of college football coming up. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, so after an early sell-off, investors fought back against the traditional September swoon. The Dow Industrials cut its losses to 54 points today, 0.4%, 13,035 at the bell. The NASDAQ up 8 points, 0.25%, finished at 3,075. The S&P 500 shed a point, 0.1%, 1,404, the number you're looking for. Disappointing reports on factory output and construction spending drove industrial shares down. Machinery maker Caterpillar was the biggest blue-chip loser, closed down 0.3%. United Technologies, maker of everything from elevators to jet engines, fell 1.9% today. Car sales, as we told you, provided a fillip on a day of sobering economic news. Yeah, Philip, look it up. Ford shares accelerated 0.75%. General Motors reversed 0.2%, but still did better than the overall market. Facebook's woes mounted. Two big investment banks that took the company public cut their price targets for the stock today, and thus Facebook shares sagged nearly 2%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.57%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its revised productivity and costs report for the second quarter. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton continues meeting with Chinese leaders in Beijing during an 11-day tour overseas. And on September 5th, 1882, the first Labor Day holiday was celebrated in New York City. It became a federal holiday in 1894. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Obama squeaked out a win in North Carolina last time round, but a poll out yesterday by Elon University and the Charlotte Observer shows Governor Romney up by 4 percentage points. In part, it's because of that "are you better off now than you were 4 years ago" question that's been bouncing around the past couple of days. And North Carolina's furniture industry is feeling it in particular. It's lost 40,000 jobs in the past decade. Marketplace's David Gura has been out and about in the Tar Heel State this summer for our coverage of the things that are really going to matter this fall, the real economy, we're calling it. And in the first of two stories from Lincolnton today, about an hour outside Charlotte, a guy who's trying to put the furniture pieces back together again. Here's David.
In 1996, Bruce Cochran's family sold the furniture company they'd owned here for four generations to another American manufacturer. Cochran says they couldn't compete with lower-cost Asian imports.
It was a difficult decision. It was probably a lot more difficult for my father and my uncle than it was for me because they were people persons, and they literally actually loved the people that worked here.
But before long, the new owners moved the whole operation overseas. And by 2008, when the last Cochran furniture factory closed here, 1,300 workers had lost their jobs. But 3 years later, Cochran decided to reopen that old factory. There were sentimental reasons, sure. But he says it also made economic sense. It's not as cheap as it used to be to make furniture in China. In January, Cochran started his new venture, Lincolnton Furniture. The factory floor is filled with the screech and whine of saws and routers. Cochran shows off new state-of-the-art equipment and his furniture.
You can actually see into the finish. You can actually see the wood.
Today, Cochran has 72 employees, and he introduces me to worker after worker he's hired back. Like Joe Rudisil, a plant manager. Rudisil worked for Cochran's family for decades, just like his dad did.
It meant a lot to me. This is all I ever done is work in furniture, and that's the only thing I've ever known. It meant a lot to me to be able to come back to work here.
Cochran is proud of what he's done. Lincolnton Furniture, he tells me, has a great story. And it's a story that had legs, especially after a recession. Months before workers finished their first dresser and dining room table, Cochran was all over the local news.
By early next year, you'll start seeing a new furniture brand, Lincolnton Furniture, in stores. That means jobs in a county that needs them.
And soon, he hit the national news.
Harry Smith visited a factory owner who sent his company's jobs to China, but then home called him back.
And he got fan letters.
Dear Mr. Cochran.
They're pinned to a big bulletin board in his office.
You're building furniture in the USA, and I wanted to commend you for it. I believe the only way our country will survive is if manufacturing returns to our shores. I've been actively seeking made-in-America products.
Cochran's become a poster boy for so-called insourcing, or bringing jobs back to the U.S. The Boston Consulting Group estimates the U.S. will add between 2 and 3 million manufacturing-related jobs over the next 3 years as higher labor costs make Chinese products less competitive. Politicians also thought Lincolnton Furniture was a great story. And soon those fan letters gave way to invitations to meet North Carolina's Democratic governor, Bev Perdue, to go to Washington. There's a picture of Cochran with the state's Democratic senator, Kay Hagan. Actually, Cochran had traveled to D.C. to meet someone else.
Thank you, everybody. Please, please, have a seat.
President Obama brought Cochran to the White House in January for the administration's Insourcing American Jobs Forum. The president was planning a major manufacturing initiative, and Lincolnton Furniture was a company he could point to. Obama beamed as he talked about Cochran's bio, about how Cochran had traveled overseas as a consultant for companies that had outsourced manufacturing to Asia.
While he was there, though, he noticed something he didn't expect. Their customers actually wanted to buy things made in America.
2 weeks later, President Obama unveiled a plan to offer tax breaks to encourage insourcing during the State of the Union. And Cochran, well, he was right there as a guest of the First Lady.
Tonight, my message to business leaders is simple. Ask yourselves what you can do to bring jobs back to your country. And your country will do everything we can to help you succeed.
That was 8 months ago now.
Have you made up your mind yet who you're going to vote for?
I have. I'm going to vote for Mitt Romney for sure.
Cochran likes that Romney's background is in business, and Cochran says he's learned a thing or two about the way government works over the last year, on both sides of the aisle.
You have a general willingness for the politicians to take credit for what we did.
Were they incentivizing it at all? I mean, was it something that they were helping to make happen?
No, not a bit. You know, they didn't have anything to do with this.
Cochran says that what he needed most when he was starting Lincolnton Furniture was access to capital, loans to upgrade his factory. That money was hard to come by, and politicians didn't deliver on promises to improve that. This year, he's hoping to double the size of his workforce, but even that would give him just a tenth of the people his family business used to employ. In Lincolnton, North Carolina, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks. We talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blogs of the same name. It is Everybody Now. Yes, the hidden side of everything. Dubner, how are you?
Hey, Kai. I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right. You know, getting by.
Yep. So the new college football season is upon us
it
now.
Is.
It's always
it
exciting.
Is.
The, you know, just unbelievable sheer athleticism you see, the marching
yep.
bands, and,
yep.
and the freshmen barfing all over the
okay,
stadium.
Okay, wait, what? Because that's not
yeah.
what I was expecting.
Yeah, no, that's what I want to talk to you about today. Let me start with Oliver Luck. He is
yes.
the athletic director at West Virginia University. That's what he got used to seeing at football games there.
Ew.
People drinking far too much at pregame parties, tailgate parties before games, sneaking alcohol into games, leaving at halftime to drink even more and come back into the game.
Now, Oliver Luck happens to be the father of quarterback Andrew Luck, who is
oh.
this year's number one NFL draft
yes,
pick.
Yes, he was.
New QB for the Indianapolis Colts.
Got that right.
Oliver
Big
Luck,
shoes to
the
fill.
Papa... That's right. Yep. The Papa was an NFL quarterback himself for a few years.
Okay.
And now, as a college athletic director, he learned that most colleges, in keeping with their academic mission, do not sell alcohol at football games.
I didn't
but,
know that.
Not surprisingly, that doesn't stop everybody, including students, from drinking, especially because some schools, West Virginia among them, they have what's called a pass-out policy.
A now, what?
Yes, you heard me right, but you're thinking differently.
I am. That's right.
This does not have anything to do with passing out from drinking too much.
Right.
It has to do with the fact that you are allowed to pass out of the stadium and back in during the game, which means
okay.
you can go out and drink.
This whole thing is not shocking, right? That's the point.
It is not, but that doesn't mean you have to be happy about it or even tolerate
sure.
it. So Oliver Luck last year proposed that two things. One, that West Virginia get rid of that pass-out policy and that it try something different inside the stadium.
Okay.
So, you know, I began to think a little bit, you know, sort of counterintuitively that actually selling beer at our stadium would actually help us gain control.
So here's where I need you to explain the counterintuitive thing, right? Because how does it – I mean, you get some money from the beer sales, but how does it help you control the problem if you're actually selling the beverage.
Let's do the money first. West Virginia did clear about $500,000 from beer sales that first year. Projected it'll probably double this year, right? That's
wow.
nice.
That's a lot of beer.
But you're right. Now that you're selling beer in the stadium, you might think you're going to have more alcohol trouble, more arrests for underage drinking, more violence. And that is what the campus police at West Virginia last year, in the first year, were prepared for. But that is not what happened. Here's Police Chief Bob Roberts.
Yeah, in 2010, we made 117 arrests on game days. And then this past year, we only made 79. See, that's almost – well, that's 35% reduction in arrest we made.
Which is good. So what's his name, Luck, trying to sell this to other schools? I mean, get them to try it?
I wouldn't say he's an evangelist quite, but when they come – when they see what's happening there and they come for help, he gives it. The University of Minnesota, for instance, wanted to try selling beer in the stadium. It had to get, however, support from the state legislature first, and Luck did talk to some legislative aides along the way. And now, as a result, this fall, Minnesota will be starting a 2-year trial of beer sales.
Yeah, which totally makes sense, right? You can drink 50 feet outside the stadium gates, but you can't inside, right? Come on.
Exactly. I mean, look, this is complicated, and you don't want to make light of it. Alcohol abuse is a very major problem on college campuses and elsewhere. And the idea of making more alcohol available in more places may strike some people as ridiculous. But what I like about this approach is that instead of, you know, when you've got a problem, you can stick your head in the sand or you can acknowledge the problem exists and try to come up with a new kind of solution. And that, I think, is what we're talking about here. Listen again, Kai, to West Virginia University Police Chief Bob Roberts.
Okay.
You know, you might as well face reality and try to control it and at least keep the environment as safe as you can.
How's that for a motto, Kai? Controlling reality one day at a time. I like that, huh?
That's right. Stephen Dubner, he tries to do that every day of his life. Freakonomics.com is the website. He is back in a couple of weeks. See you, man.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which, as it happens, comes the same day that Apple sent out invites for what's expected to be the unveiling of the iPhone 5. It's a big to-do set for a week from tomorrow. This morning, though, we woke up to news that a hacker group had released a million Apple IDs, IDs that in some cases contain cell phone numbers and other personal stuff you just don't want out there in public. It's part of a haul of 12 million IDs the group says it could have published. How do I know this? Because I read it on my iPad. Yeah. Anyway, so iPhone 5 in a week. Get ready for the deluge of standard Apple unveiling announcement coverage, huh? All right, that's it. We got to go. Today, the Dow fell 54 points, about 0.4%, 13,035 at the bell. The NASDAQ up 8 points, 0.25%, 3,075. The S&P 500 off 0.1%, 1,404. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Mary Dew, and Justin Ho on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Haas and Rod Bead. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.